We now move on to number 3, labeled Aristotle's Embryology, which begins our discussion of the ancient understanding of and ethical circumstances relating to embryology, the understanding of human growth and development during pregnancy, and the consequences of this for the practice in antiquity of contraception and abortion. Aristotle's embryology is very important. Aristotle has a great number of observations that were primarily concerned with what would later be called natural philosophy and what we would today call science, observing the universe and trying to understand how the natural world works. And so Aristotle gathers together what was known about embryology, both in animals and in human beings, which is primarily derived from what could be seen or what was observed if a woman had a spontaneous abortion for one reason or another, if she didn't carry her pregnancy to term, and noting as observers, early scientists did in the ancient world, and again we're talking about the 4th and 5th centuries BC, who would have come to conclusions about the gradual formation of the human embryo and how it begins to look more and more like a human being. Aristotle's embryology is important because it will be quoted, it will influence, as we'll see, Jewish ethics, and much later it will influence the ethical discussions within Christianity when the philosophy of Aristotle is reintroduced into the West, roughly speaking during the rise of Scholasticism, and then is incorporated to some extent into the writings of St. Thomas Aquinas. Aristotle gets it wrong very significantly, but his convictions carry weight for many centuries. And in this section from his treatise, on the human embryo, what we find is a description of, and this is inaccurate, the first movement, which is sometimes referred to as quickening, he says takes place around the 40th day. That's not correct, but in any case, he would later conclude that for males, this awareness of the fact that one is carrying a child meant that there was now significant life, significant human life. That this 40th day, in the case of men or male embryos, and in the case of the 90th day for female embryos, would be an important time, a time which represented its acquisition of the real life principle. And that became an understanding in antiquity, that there was something very significant that happened at some stage in human development before which one did not have a fully human, alive reality, and after which one did. And Aristotle's scientific treatise was later taken as a description of exactly when this happened. 40th day in the case of males, 90th day in the case of females. Now, if you read down, and we won't look at this in detail, he describes what are thought to be some observations of human embryos at this point, and what he concludes from it as a result of this. Again, we don't need to look at that in detail, but to realize that his convictions about the 40th and the 90th day will be rather enshrined in classical literature and will be regarded as scientific knowledge, which then influences theological discussion, as we'll see, in Judaism, and then much later, during the medieval period, in Christianity. We now turn to a dark aspect of Aristotle's thought, and by dark, I mean dark from the perspective of moral goodness. You can see the bar that I've labeled Aristotle on eugenics. In his Politics, he describes the means of creation, what he regards as an ideal state. And one of the means that he proposes that should be used is the elimination of defective children. He says that no deformed child shall be reared. In other words, infanticide should be practiced if children are born with defects. And if you drop down towards the end of this section, he recommends limiting the number of children through the practice of abortion. And particularly, he emphasizes that an early abortion is somehow, as he puts it, lawful, or more literally, permissible. And he distinguishes between permissible and impermissible abortions by the question of the age of gestation, believing that it's less morally problematic if the embryo has not yet developed sensation and is not yet what he believes to be alive, if it doesn't have aesthesis, sensation, or life, zoe. And these markers of 40 days for the male embryo and 90 days for the female embryo are undoubtedly what he has in mind here. Again, these practices or principles would have been very congenial, highly regarded by the practitioners of eugenics in the 20th century, particularly in the Third Reich, and unfortunately, as we shall see, in the United States as well. If we drop down now to number 4, infanticide, contraception, and abortion in the Roman Empire, the first point we should note in number 4.1 is that infanticide, the killing of a newborn infant, was not only tolerated or permitted, but it was very widely practiced in the Roman Empire. And recent excavations in various sites have confirmed this, that there are large locations where there are the large numbers of dead newborn infants, many of whom show no evidence of having died of diseases. But this simply represents the practice, unfortunately, which still goes on today, of parents destroying unwanted children. In this case, infanticide in the ancient Roman Empire would have been, on the one hand, when a husband or the pater familias, that would have been the male figure who was in charge of a particular family household, determined whether or not he was going to acknowledge the child as his legitimate offspring. And that happened after the child was born. If he reached over and picked up that child and lifted up and acknowledged it, that created a legal status. The child was acknowledged to be a part of the family. If he did not do that, he was within his right, or the family was within their right, to, quote, expose, unquote, the child. An exposure could be a variety of things. It could mean that someone would take the child and simply leave it, abandon the child in a public place, in the marketplace, for example, or if there was a specific intention that the child should die. For example, if the child was born with an obvious birth defect, the child could be left in a more remote location, specifically so that the child would die. Now, if the child was left in a marketplace or in a public place, the reality was it would probably be taken up by someone who would make that child into a slave, and very often who would make that child into a slave prostitute and become part of the sex industry. So exposure either meant death or pretty much a lifetime of servitude for children. And exposure, as we'll see in this specific document, appears to have been very commonly for the simple fact of being female. That is, the exposure of female infants seems to have been quite common in classical antiquity. It is tragically still not uncommon in the developing world today. And so if you look down a little bit, I've given you both the original form of this text from a soldier named Hilarion, who was stationed in the city of Alexandria in Egypt in the year 1 BC, that is the 29th year of Caesar Augustus. And he writes this note to his wife. He technically calls her his sister, which sounds a little odd to us, but it's just an appellation, a way of referring to his sister. And and her name is Alice or Alice. And if you drop down below the Greek transcription to the English translation, Hilarion writes to his wife Alice hearty greetings, also to Berus and Apollinarion, people who presumably lived with his wife in the region to which he was sending this letter. Know that I'm still in Alexandria, and do not worry if I stay in Alexandria when all the others return. I ask and beg you to take good care of the child. This is presumably a child who already was in the household, and if I receive my pay soon, I will send it on to you. Well, he's heard that his wife is pregnant. Above all, if you bear a child and it is male, let it be. But if it is female, expose it. Now, the term used here is ekbale, and that literally means throw it away, cast the child away. You have told Aphrodisias, do not forget me, but how could I forget you? Thus I ask you not to worry. Notice the casualness with which he just, you know, sort of dismissively or as a kind of a side thought mentions, oh, by the way, keep the child if it's a boy, but expose it, that is to say, kill it, or leave the child to be raised as a slave by someone else if it's a girl. So this is a reminder to us of how brutally children, newborns, could be regarded in classical antiquity, and we'll see what a tremendous contrast there was within the Jewish and the Christian communities in regard to this particular point. Now, against that background, of course, you can imagine that there was no societal prohibition of either contraception or abortion. However, abortion could very often threaten the life of the mother because there were no specific drugs that would cause an abortion. As I mentioned earlier in a previous lecture, there were drugs that would cause vomiting, drugs that would cause diarrhea, drugs that would eventually cause the body to go into a kind of spasm. And as a result of this, you know, this terrible, devastating poisoning of the body, it's possible that a pregnant woman could have a spontaneous abortion, not primarily because of the drug, but just basically because the body is very near to going into convulsions. So abortive remedies, that is, taken by mouth, could be very devastating and dangerous to the woman. And if an abortion were attempted using an instrument, that is to destroy the child surgically, that also ran the very, very significant risk of introducing a life-threatening infection in the mother. And as we'll see, medical authors who even describe how to induce an abortion are very leery about recommending the use of any medical instruments because these are very dangerous. So again, although abortion was not illegal, it was dangerous and therefore would occasionally be discouraged in the medical literature. Again, this is in a Greco-Roman society. And we'll be looking primarily at the medical author Serranus. His lifespan is not exactly known. He probably lived from around, was active from somewhere around 80 to 110 AD. So in the latter part of the first century, in the beginning of the second century after Christ, he writes a very, very famous series of treatises, some of which have come down to us, describing diseases of women and obstetrical and gynecological practices. And in this treatise, in the section that I've given you, he discusses the question of whether drugs or practices that cause abortion or contraception may be used, and how to use them. That gives you an idea as to how he's going to conclude. And he says, first of all, he distinguishes between them. A contraceptive is different from an abortifacient, whereas a contraceptive prevents conception from happening, an abortifacient destroys what has been conceived. And so he distinguishes between these two, and he also describes between different kinds of abortifacients. One employs one means and another does something else. And he also then notes that that in the Hippocratic treatise, while there is a text that forbids the use of drugs or medications that expel or cause abortion, which he describes as expulsive abortifacients, nevertheless, in a Hippocratic treatise which he knows, and this is true, in the treatise on the nature of the child, there is a description of a practice of leaping, which was thought to induce a spontaneous abortion, of physical for exercises for the sake of causing abortion. So what he's hinting at is the fact that although there is a disapproval of abortion in this classical series of treatises, nevertheless, there is a description of how to do it. And so he now describes the controversy. If you drop a little further down, a controversy has arisen, for one side rejects abortifacients, citing the testimony of Hippocrates, and he adds, the purpose of medicine is to care for and to preserve what has been engendered by nature, while there's another side, that is to say, another set of medical opinions in his day, day, the day of Saranus, which prescribes abortifacients, but with some limitations. What are these limitations? That is, physicians who prescribe or permit or describe how to or facilitate abortion do not do it when a person wishes to destroy the embryo because of adultery or out of consideration for youthful beauty. That is, the person doesn't want to change their figure by having carrying pregnancy to term. But this would only be done, abortion would only be permitted, to prevent subsequent danger in parturition, that is, in childbirth, if the uterus is small and not capable of accommodating development, and so on and so forth. So what he's effectively saying is he would tend to side with those who would not perform elective abortions for any reason, but would allow them for what he regards as medical reasons. And then he goes on to describe contraceptive practices. The blue line on contraception, he says, since it is safer to prevent conception from taking place than to destroy the fetus, we'll now discourse upon such prevention. For it is much more advantageous not to conceive than to destroy the embryo. And he then talks about sexual intercourse at certain times of the month, which are more likely to result in pregnancy or not. An early awareness of the fundamental basis of what in the Catholic Church we describe as natural family planning. And then I have not included his detailed description of physical activities and devices and medications that were believed to inhibit conception, some of which were probably worthless, some of which might have had that effect, but to a limited degree. And he even notes that many of these have dangerous side effects. Then he goes on in section 64 to describe abortion. If conception's taken place, one must first, for 30 days, do the opposite of what we said earlier. That is to say, what would be done during pregnancy to prevent a spontaneous abortion. And he talks particularly about vigorous exercise, energetic walking, even physically shaking the individual, leaping energetically. And then, at the bottom, he says she should use diuretic decoctions, that is, drugs that would increase urination, urinary flow. And then I've not included a detailed list of both activities and drugs which he believed would actually facilitate or cause an abortion. And then in number 65, he describes what a woman needs to do ahead of time if she's going to have an abortion, including bleeding, removing a significant amount of blood, that is, bringing the body to the point that the body would experience great danger, and all kinds of things might happen that would go along with preventing death, and that would possibly even result in the expulsion of a pregnancy, but again with danger to the mother. And he finally concludes, much has been said on this subject by others. One must be guard against treatments that are too powerful, and of detaching the embryo with a sharp instrument. He's very concerned about this because he says there is danger to the surrounding tissues, and after all abortion, one has to treat the person as for inflammation. So, in summary, although there is in the medical literature and among physicians an awareness that there is a reserve in prescribing devices or medications or practices that are either contraceptive or abortifacient, nonetheless, Saranus, with the majority of physicians, believes that contraception is better than abortion, but abortion may be permitted in certain circumstances. And indeed, it seems unlikely that the primary concern was what we would call moral or ethical, but the observed reality that these drugs and devices that induced abortion were in fact, in many cases, very dangerous to the mother and in fact often not effective in causing an abortion. And we'll stop this lecture at this point.